funeral.
The last time that we did a meet before Shavuos, a week or so, and I thought it would be a good idea would be to pick up some loose ends of a subject that we've begun before. That's one of the most misunderstood subjects, and the most importantly misunderstood subjects there is, and that's the idea of tefillah, what's called the davening. In English, we call it prayer, but that's not what we mean. The word in English has got connotations of very non-Jewish activity. Davening, tefillah, is the highest meditation that there could be. Not only that, but it's a distinct obligation. Not only that, but your life depends on it. And not only that, but the existence and life of the world, the Jewish world and the world in general, depends on that. There are some authorities that say that if you don't daven properly, you don't know what it means, and you don't engage in activity with a full meditational power that you should, so the rest of the Jewish world can have a claim on you that you are bringing about damage to them, right? That you're responsible for damage that occurs to them, because you have it in your power to bring down what's called Shefa, that means to bring down from the spiritual world, to bring down power that causes certain effects in the world, prevents certain damage and causes certain beneficial things, and you're not doing that. And every Jew's tefillah is necessary, and you're not doing it. And therefore, some authorities say that if Jews live in a community and a Jew doesn't come to shul, that means there's a Jew who doesn't daven, stays home, he's called a Shochein Ra. Shochein Ra means a bad neighbor, but it means an evil neighbor. It means a maliciously evil neighbor. So the commentaries say, why is he called evil? He doesn't daven. He doesn't want to meditate. He doesn't want to get himself into that spiritual high. And why is he called a bad neighbor? But you can understand, the reason is he's called a bad neighbor because he's damaging you, because we need him. My tefillahs don't get through unless you put yours in. We don't affect the changes that we need to affect in the world unless each of us puts in that meditation, right? Because collectively we can generate a power that's much deeper than any of us can do individually. Let's try and understand, what is this meditational idea? What does it mean? Now, we're going to talk about some of the highest things that there are, so we have to stay together now. First of all, you have to understand the following thing. This is probably the least understood aspect of davening, is that it is directly linked to the mechanism that powers the cosmic structure. Directly linked, not vaguely linked, but directly linked in. So intimately linked into the cosmic structure that, again, if you don't put in that energy, things won't happen. That means it's not that you're asking for something that you want because you feel you want to ask, or because you're pouring your heart out in Tehillim, or whatever it is. It's not the idea. It's that idea also. But it's much, much more potent than that. It's locking into the system in such a way that you actually cause the system to move. Even though what's causing the whole system to move is Hashem's Ratzon, that means what Hashem wants, but he makes what he wants and what he does in the world subservient to your asking for it, to our asking for it. And that's a fascinating thing that people don't understand. The dismal truth is that in this generation it almost doesn't operate. Well, we'll have to see what that means. But in terms of what it should do, it's almost, we're almost powerless. But the tragedy is that we're powerless because we don't understand. If we understood what that power of that meditation was and we put the energy in, the whole thing would come alive immediately, instantaneously. But because we don't actually understand, if you want to put it in crude terms, we don't believe that saying those words or putting your energy into that spiritual world is going to make a difference, so we don't put the energy in properly. And then it has no value. The Gemara says that if a person takes 3 steps back after the Shemona Esrei, right, he's been meditating in this position and he's supposed to have been davening, but actually he wasn't concentrating. Right? He took 3 steps back at the end and he takes 3 steps forward immediately, which means he doesn't actually perceive that he's come down from a very high world. It says it's like a dog returning to his vomit. That's what the Gemara says. And the Gemara doesn't exaggerate and it doesn't seek out poetic or, you know, forceful phrases. Gemara means it literally. And just like a dog goes back and eats his vomit, that's what a person is doing. He spits out meaningless words, and it's worse than that. It's disgusting, because you spit out words that should have been the highest connection. If you want a crude marshal, it's like a husband who's in a very intimate situation with his wife and he's talking to her, not even thinking about her at all. Think about somebody else. Now, that's the element, that's the feeling of disgust that the spiritual world experiences when a person puts himself in that situation. And that's of course why it's so difficult. That's why it's almost impossible to concentrate just for more than a few seconds at a time. And that's why the Rambam and Paskins, and we have it clearly brought down in Halacha, that if you have concentration and you mean what you say, and just for the first of the 19 blessings, all 19 brokers in Shemoneh, so if you mean what you say, and just for the first one, you fulfilled your obligation. That's a pathetic thing to have. Imagine telling somebody that and get 1 out of 19. But 1 out of 19 is good enough. We'll fulfill, regard you as having fulfilled your obligation. But the reason is it's so difficult to get right. That if you can just hold by what you're saying and really mean it and focus in and lock in at a minimal level just for one of them, that's considered already to have really made a difference. Somebody who can train himself after a week or 2 weeks to hold through the first one, and then he can have intention for the second one. He can actually feel the difference and he can feel the change. That's a remarkable thing. So we have a very, very hard job. We have to understand how powerful this idea is, how low we are in this area, why we don't feel response when we daven, because we're not really davening, and to understand it so powerfully that if a person puts his mind into it accurately and correctly, actually will feel the response. It's 100% guaranteed. If you know what you're doing, you actually experience the response in tefillah. There are very few areas like that in the spiritual world, and you have to know this is one of them. In the spiritual world, if you put the effort in, the kedusha that results, the feeling, the sensation, the elevation that you get out of it, and the effect that happens in the world, they're very unusual, very few and far between areas where you get a genuine feeling. You can be misled by your intuition. Your intuition can tell you that you're actually having a high, but actually, very often we don't know whether it's a lower self speaking, or whether it actually is your higher self speaking. We're in a generation now where your intuition cannot be trusted. Right? You have to first wipe out totally all ego before you can trust your intuition. And that's very hard, and davening helps with that too. So let's try and understand the power of this area and how it works. Complicated area. One has to know from the beginning that even if one puts one's energy incorrectly, sometimes the response is not what you expect. He was a very great leader. And he had a very great mystical background also. One of his followers, one of his talmidim, came to him one day and he said, "What's wrong with my tefillah? I'm davening, I've had so much trouble." This man had been through agony, and he was going through agony. "And I'm davening and davening, I'm asking Hashem for what I need, and he's not answering me." So the Rebbe said to him, "You are being answered." The answer is no. Mm-hmm. Understand? There's a way of davening that the answer will be yes also. But first, the only way to get there is to understand that if the answer is no, it doesn't make any difference to you. Right? It's an amazing paradox of killing of the ego that a person has to understand. I'm trying to get to grips with this. In the case of a certain contemporary Hasidic leader, who they say, this is the story, they say that a woman came to him whose son was dying. The boy had certain illness and he had only a very short time left in him. So the woman sat with the Rebbe and she cried and she said that she told him the story and she wanted the Rebbe to daven. So the Rebbe said to her the following thing: "If you knew that Hashem wanted your son, if you knew that Hashem wanted your son right now, that he wasn't going to live, and that was really what Hashem wanted, would you be able to give him up? Before we daven, if you knew that he had to die, that means that Hashem needs this. This is what's needed in the world, and that's what Hashem wants. Could you give him up?" So the woman sat for a long time agonizing over her emotions, and finally she said yes. He said, "Fine, now we can daven." And they davened together, and the boy lived, actually. Still alive. Understand, it's an amazing paradox that's involved. Let's try and take it apart together and understand. They're hard to express these things. The Gemara says this. Let's start in the following way. Gemara says, when Rebbe was dying, Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, not the greatest man of his generation, a man so great that the Gemara says clearly, openly, without any, in a section of the Gemara, it's not dealing with any mystical concepts, not on the surface. The Gemara says that when Rebbe died, after he died, every Friday afternoon he used to come home, that means to his house, in his body, he used to come home, and he used to enter the house. Before he died, the Gemara says, he said to his family that there should be a bed made, a table laid, and a candle lit every Friday afternoon, before Erev Shabbos, Kiddush time. After he died, he used to come back, he used to walk into the house, he used to make Kiddush, and he used to be there in his body, after he had died. So the Gemara says, one day his maid, the maid in Rebbe's house was a very great woman. You'll see in a while, we learn amazing things from her in Gemara. This maid, one day, got a little upset with people outside, and she said, "Be quiet, Rebbe's here." When Rebbe heard that people outside knew that he was around, he said, "He's not coming back." Because he didn't want to be an embarrassment to others who didn't do that. He didn't want to have any reflection. For a certain reason, he didn't come back again. That was the man we're talking about. And the Gemara mentions it totally, even the Gemara mentions it only to bring certain things that we learn from it, but not to tell you that it's in any way surprising that Rebbe should have the capacity to do that. This world and the next world are the same, made no difference to him. It made no difference. Wearing a body, not wearing a body, putting the body back on after he'd taken it off, made no difference to him at all. The body, of course, was perfectly intact. You know that. You know that the great tzaddikim, that the bodies do not decompose after death. So, that is Rebbe. Now, the way Rebbe died before this thing happened was as follows. A very, very interesting story. The Gemara says this. Rebbe was very sick. He was very sick. He had a certain kind of suffering that great people have. It says certain kind of illness can affect people in a certain way. Doesn't matter. He was suffering very greatly. The Gemara says that actually, it's a fascinating Gemara. It has a lot of medical application. Also, the Gemara says that when he was suffering very badly, the maid in the house, this great woman, perceived how great his suffering was, and it says that she davened that he should die. She davened that he should die. You have to understand that. And the whole Beis Medrash of Revi, all the Talmidim who were davening that he should live, when they heard her say that, they all davened that he should die, and he died. You have to understand now. You know the primacy of saving a life in Jewish thought. What does it mean that you can daven that someone can die? She says, it says in Halacha that if somebody is suffering very greatly, of course you may not make any action that causes the person to die, but to daven that someone should die when it's considered inevitable, and of course we're not in a position to make that judgment, but she was, and the suffering is very great. It says that she saw him take off his tefillin repeatedly. He had to keep taking off his tefillin to use the bathroom. So she understood he was suffering very greatly, and he must have been suffering enormously, because there's another place in the Gemara that it says that Rebbe suffered for 13 years very greatly, and he suffered so greatly that the fishermen on the Kinneret could hear his screams. That means out on the Galilee, Kinneret, the Yama Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, the fishermen could hear him screaming. So he must have been suffering enormously, and that was nothing compared to this, because then no one davened for him to die. In fact, he took those on, well, he didn't take them on voluntarily, but there were certain kind of sufferings that had a spiritual, certain spiritual effects resulted in the world. So this is what happened. He was suffering very greatly. She saw him taking off his tefillin repeatedly, he had to use the bathroom, and she davened. First she said, may it be the will of the higher forces. That day. First she said this, before she realized how badly it was suffering, her prayer was phrased like this, may it be the will of the lower forces to overcome the upper forces. What she meant was that the Talmidim and the Beis Medrash of Rebbe were davening that he should live, and in Shamayim they were causing him to die, when they could see that he was dying. So she davened first that the lower ones should overcome the upper ones. That the lower ones should force the upper ones, bend them to their will. And if then, that means that it's in a person's power, and this is the first thing we have to understand this evening, for a person in the world to say that it should happen, that our will should overcome the spiritual will. That means in the world of truth, the world of MS, a certain force is coming down, we can overturn that. Quite literally. Now this wasn't an emotional outburst. This was something that actually kept him alive. And he lived. And while the Talmidim heard her say that, they davened for him. And as they all sat and davened, they said to him, he lived. Then when she saw how badly he was suffering, she changed the words around. She said, may it be the will of the higher ones to overcome the lower ones. When they heard that, they stopped davening and he died. Now the Gemara says a very amazing thing. While he was dying, they were davening, they were praying, let's say. And they issued a statement, the Talmidim, the Beis Medrash of Rebbe, they issued a statement as follows. Let anyone who says that Rebbe has died be pierced with a sword. Idoka b'cherem, that's what it says. Amazing thing. If anybody says that Rebbe has died, this is on the day that he was dying. If anyone says that Rebbe has died, he should be pierced with a sword. And they meant it literally. That was a gzera. That meant they issued a proclamation, right, that if anybody would say that he died, then he would be pierced with a sword. So the Rishonim all ask, what kind of a statement is that? I mean, what were they doing? What did they mean? Why was there such a... What was so bad about saying that he died? And the commentaries say, the Rishonim say, that what they meant was that if anybody said that Rebbe had died, even if he had died, he would be killed. You understand? That means like this. Let's say Rebbe is in some place where he's suffering and the people are dying. Some place in some other part of the land, that's Israel, somebody comes along and says, today Rebbe's died. Without knowing whether he has or hasn't. Even genuinely under the misapprehension that he has died. Even if Rebbe has died already and he's saying the truth, he deserves to be killed. In fact, then we will kill him. Why? Now, you know in Jewish law there's no way to kill somebody unless he's threatening someone else's life. So the question is, it means that if this person says Rebbe's died, he must be threatening the life of Rebbe. But the problem is, how does he threaten his life if he's died already? Are you with me? You don't need too much of a Gemara cup for this. Huh? Are you with me? I'm not going to enjoy the explanation unless you hear the problem. So, Neshtim Makrubet is one of the great Rishonim, they answer as follows. It's a very, very amazing thing to understand. The reason is as follows. If Rebbe was dying, and they were potentially dying, and they were davening, they were keeping him alive. That's our understanding. the power of their tefillah, right, of that meditation, was so great that it could keep him alive. And therefore, if anyone would come along and say that Rebbe died, so they'd all stop davening. Because we have a din that you don't daven for somebody who's died already to come alive again. Not allowed to do that. We'll have to understand why in a moment. Therefore, they would stop davening that he should stay alive, and Rebbe would die. So they cost him his life. The greatest man of the generation, they needed him very badly. So therefore, if anybody said that he died and he caused them to stop davening and then he died, of course that person would be responsible for his death. So they didn't want anyone to say that. Should be very careful what they said. So they made such a proclamation. But the amazing part of the story is that why were they so anxious that someone shouldn't say it, even if he had died already? And that's unbelievable. And this is said in an even tone, absolutely straightforward halacha, right? Not, you won't find this in the mystical writings. This it says openly in the commentaries on the Gemara. Because listen to this. Had Rebbe died, and the people in the Beis Medrash of Rebbe didn't know that he died, and they davened, he'd definitely come alive again. There's no question about that. You hear that? If they davened, they're busy davening for Rebbe, and unknown to them, he's died. That wouldn't make any difference. The power of the tefillah, without any question, would definitely resurrect him. And therefore, if somebody came along and said that Rebbe's died, and now they stopped davening, even if he had died, so now the resurrection wouldn't take place anymore. And Itaka would stay dead. So for that, they deserve to be killed, because it's costing him his life. You hear that? It makes no difference whether he's living or dead. Absolutely no difference. Not at all. Not the slightest. The power of their tefillah is so powerful that it will give him life, whether he's alive makes no difference at all. Whether naturally in the physical world he's here or not, the tefillah will cause him to be alive again. What do you see from this Gemara? And then you see it in many places in the Gemara. You see that the power to resurrect the dead, that means not just to bring down Shefa to the world, not just to make it rain when it needs to rain, right? But to make someone alive whose body is not alive anymore, put that neshama back into the body, is absolutely within the realm of tefillah. That meditation is so powerful that you could connect to the source in such a way that the source would connect to you in such a way that that energy would flow back into the world, right? And it would reconnect with whatever in any target you force that only we have a din, and I don't know if we can go into this evening, that you're not allowed to daven for someone who is not alive anymore for certain reasons. Let's say you have to know what you're doing, let's put it that way. If you want a general rule, you're not allowed to do it. There are certain circumstances where it is allowed. The commentaries ask, why did Elisha do it? He came across a boy who had died, and he davened. He brought him back to life again. In fact, he did it twice, and Eliyahu did it once. We have cases like that. David HaMelech davened for a child who was dying, and it says he was fasting and davening, and when the boy died, he stopped fasting, he called for food. Why didn't he daven that the child should come to life again? You have to know what you're doing. You have to know what you're doing. In the case of Rebbe, it wasn't appropriate. In David HaMelech's case, it was. But what we want, and we'll have to discuss that another time, but what we want from this evening is to understand that the koyach of this energy, the power of this energy is unlimited. That's what you have to understand. And in many, many cases in the Gemara, never mind in generations when there were prophets around, there are many cases of ordinary people. I mean, in our terms, they're certainly not ordinary. But in terms of the Gemara's day, people reached a level where they could do anything through the power of tefillah. Literally, miraculous events. Turn nature upside down, inside out, through the power of their tefillah. And there are many, many examples. The classical one that springs to mind to talk about the resurrection, just give you one more example. The Gemara says that Rebbe himself, when he was a very old man, prior to this story, used to learn together, used to study with a Roman Caesar, Antoninus. Antoninus in English is called Marcus Aurelius. In fact, he wrote many things. You can read today the writings of Marcus Aurelius. It brings down things that he learned from the great Jewish leader. He doesn't say that. Antoninus was his name. He used to come and visit Rebbe, and he used to visit him secretly. The Gemara says he used to come through a certain tunnel, because he didn't want to be seen to visiting a Jew who was the leader of the oppressed people. And it says he used to do the following thing. The Roman used to walk in through this tunnel, secret tunnel that led to Rebbe's inner chamber. He used to take two slaves with him for an escort. When he used to arrive at Rebbe's room, he used to kill the one. And when he arrived back at his palace, he killed the other. Not any evidence. The king doesn't go alone. He goes with an escort. He used to kill him. So he did. Slaves were expendable in Rome. So the Gemara says this. One night he came to see Rebbe, and as he entered, he killed the slave, left him dead outside the door. And as he walked in to see Rebbe, he found Rebbe was not alone, but he was together with one of his youngest Talmidim, one of the smallest, one of the beginners in his Beis Medrash. One of the beginners in Rebbe's Beis Medrash. So Marcus Aurelius, Antoninus, got very upset, and he said, I told you, I never want to see you when you're with somebody else. I want to be seen alone. So Rebbe tried to placate him, and he said, Leis dein barinish. He's not human. Don't worry, he's not human. But Antoninus wasn't put off by that, and he had to get rid of him. So he said to him, do me a favor. He said to the Talmud, go and bring in, call in my slave. Go ask my slave to come in here. He thought that would take him quite some time.
right? He wanted to get him out of the room. So he said to him, go outside, you'll find my slave. Just kindly ask him to step in. That's what he said. So the Talmud walked outside and he found the slave dead. So the Gemara says he had a dilemma, because the order of a king has to be obeyed. In Jewish law, even a non-Jewish king, it has to be respected. And he had to honor the order of the king and he had to do what he said. On the other hand, to schlep in a corpse, he felt, would not be fitting the covert of the melech. They didn't know what to do. So the Gemara says he was put in a dilemma. So boy rachme v'achye. He asked for what's called rachamim, which is a certain connection with the source. We'll have to discuss it. But it means he davened and he brought him back to life and he brought him in. So when Antoninus saw him, he wasn't impressed at all. He said to Rebbe, I know that the least in your base medrash can do that. The least of your students can do that. It doesn't bother me at all. Then he wasn't at all impressed. And there are many such stories in the Gemara of what tefillah, that amazing power, can do. Okay? So it's a separate discussion why we don't use it in that area. And we actually, the Mephoshim say that when you daven for the resurrection, every morning, every day in Shmon Esrei, three times a day, the second bracha of Shmon Esrei is Mechaye Meisim. Actually, we are davening. That's a bracha that goes on the resurrection. Mephoshim say you should actually mean waking up in the morning. That's what you should focus on. You should actually mean that. You shouldn't mean the other thing. That's another discussion why. What have we learned so far? We've learned the idea that the koyach of tefillah, the power of this connection, is absolutely unlimited. It's got nothing to do with a natural result or an unnatural result. Whether the result looks natural, like a rain falls when it should fall. So it might have been happening anyway. How do you know you affected that? Or whether it's unnatural, like bringing someone who's not alive back to life again, makes absolutely no difference. And it's a promise. It's a promise. It's not that you have to be lucky or very great. It's a promise. The forces are set up in such a way, if you bring them down, they operate. If you don't bring them down, they don't. Try and understand. The way the mystical writings put it is something like this. They note this from the fact, from the following fact. It says that all davening that we do, to understand this deeply now, all davening that we do operates through the Beis HaMikdash. That means if a person puts that energy, if he can meditate correctly and get himself transcendent, then what happens is he makes a connection between him and the Beis HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, and from there the forces are transmitted into the inner world, and from there comes out the power. But it has to be done that way. And by the way, in Halacha, you know we have that din. In Halacha, what happens is you have to face Jerusalem. You have to face Yerushalayim. It doesn't make any difference where you're facing. It means spiritually, you follow. It does make a difference in Halacha, because when you face the body that way, you energize, you alive and put energy into those channels, and that's what you have to do. If you don't know which way is north, if you look here, then you can face in any direction and just do it inwardly, it says. But initially, you have to focus that way. You'll notice that many shuls in South Africa, by the way, are built in the wrong direction. You'll notice that many of them face east, because they are following halacha that was written in the northern hemisphere, where Israel is east. Actually, many shuls will actually have to turn away, because you have to face north. You have to face Yerushalayim. Be that as it may, you have to face through there. So the first thing to understand is, what's tefillah got to do with that? The spiritual world isn't located in a place on earth. Why do you have to focus through that energy, through that place? Secondly, they connected to the fact, and this is more difficult to understand, that what was unique about the Beis HaMikdash was the fact that 10 constant miracles appeared over there. There are 10 miracles that happened in the Beis HaMikdash that made it unusual. Right? All of them are connected to life energy in some way. Not easy to go through all of them. It says that no woman ever aborted, no woman ever miscarried from what went on there. Now, there were such powerful energies over there. The smell of what was... There was a certain smell in there which was so high that if a woman smelt it, and certain a pregnant woman smelt it, it was possible for her to miscarry. That never happened. In fact, it should have happened. It never happened. That was one thing. The Kohen Gadol, the highest, the priest, on the day that he was meant to enter the Kodesh Kodashim, he never had a personal accident that made him impure. Also a loss of life energy. And it goes through 10 different things that all represent life force. You have to understand what all these things mean, but all these life energies were so potent that they were perfect over there. So what do we understand? Following thing. It means that davening has to go through a place, right? Again, we're speaking in the lower world. We have to understand this inwardly. Davening, that means the power of tefillah, is an energy that you put out and it has to flow through that dimension. A dimension which is a dimension of miracle. That when night happens. Now, there are two things that happen in the Beis HaMikdash that we have to understand carefully. One is the fact that it's the place of meeting of male and female. Right? That means the spiritual world and the physical world. Hashem puts his energy, connects with the physical world at that place. Right? That means it is the place of connection. That's what it is. That's why it says it's the place of beauty, because beauty is always where harmony occurs, where opposites meet and harmonize. That's why it's a place of beauty. That's why it says that the male and female zones meet there. It says a place, the Shmaya Ba'ara Nashki Adadi, where heaven and earth kiss, it says. It's not being poetic, it means literally. It's where the male dimension of the spiritual world meets the female dimension of the practical real world, this world, and the two produce something together. That's what it's very subtly and beautifully saying. That's what the Beis HaMikdash is. We've pointed out before that one application of this idea is that the Midrash says that in the end of days, the Yishmael nations, the Arab nations, will build a holy site where the temple should be. And the Gemara says it's because their overriding negative characteristic is immorality. You hear that? Not out of political motivation, but because what's driving them in that zone is immorality. What's immorality? Forcing yourself in between husband and wife. That's what it means. So they put themselves there where we meet Hashem. That's the ultimate marriage in the world. That's the place where we and Hashem meet each other in the most intimate way. Right? That's why it says the two kruvim, where Hashem spoke with male and female, and they were embracing each other. That's what it means. It's a place of meeting, always in the hidden inner zone. That's what they've done. You understand this idea? Now, tefillah has to go through there. So what we have to understand is this, that when you daven, you go through a dimension that's the connection between physical and spiritual. That's exactly what davening is. Makes a lot of sense. Since the effort of that meditation is to raise yourself, take the physical vessel that you're in, use that as a vehicle to thrust up the spiritual being to such a high point that it almost snaps out, so you've made the connection, you've reached the source of connection between where the higher world meets the lower world. So it has to go through the Beis HaMikdash, which is a place where the two worlds meet. What has to be understood more than that is that it goes through a place where miracles are normal. A place where the miraculous is every day. And that has to be understood. Are you with me? Not even one? Jewish women have always understood this more than Jewish men. It says that the women, Jewish women used to, it wasn't a Jewish mother, didn't have a tear-soaked copy of Tehillim. Now that it was soaked with the tears. And she poured her heart out over in order to achieve what had to be achieved in the world. It wasn't an emotional, sentimental act. It was something that actually caused her family and her reality in the world to be what it was. It's always because women understand the point of connection more than men do. So the mystical sources say something like this. The reason that davening goes through a dimension of the miraculous is because a prayer is a miracle. And that's what we have to try and understand. Not easy at all. The concept of putting yourself into a world where your request, right, the form of our davening, is not a passive meditation. Right? In Eastern thinking, meditation is being able to negate the physical dimension. Right? That means it takes you to the border where a person can snap out of physical existence. In Torah, we understand that's only the prerequisite, that's just the beginning. Right? There's a reason for that, by the way, and that's because the non-Jewish nations, the non-Jewish sources of spirituality, have a great wisdom in being able to control the physical dimension, and they know how to raise, to make it, to disconnect. The Jewish element here, and that's why non-Jewish spiritual systems will never fulfill a Jewish neshama. That means they'll always burn out. Jewish neshama will always be let down. The only exception is a Jew puts himself into a spiritual system and makes money from it. That will have an ongoing thing because he actually has a physical need. But if he puts himself in for fulfillment spiritually, definitely will burn out in the end. That's what it says clearly in all the sources. Not because those systems are invalid. Not because they're invalid. They have contained great wisdom. But because he has a different spiritual source and is tuned differently. The Jewish neshama, powerful Jewish neshama, is tuned to being able to make that connection a completely different way. It's a completely different dimension of connection. And therefore, our meditation is a completely different idea. It's making that connection, but not to snap out. It's making that connection to bring the lower world up. Right? Which is what we call miracle. That's called a nes. When the physical world changes because of the connection to the source. Not gets left behind. That's not what we're trying to do. We don't try and snap out and leave the physical behind. That's an easy kind of meditation. To do that, you can have a meditation where a person becomes completely blank. Right? That is a valid source of meditational effort. That's not what davening is. In the Eastern writings, we're not here to advertise Eastern thinking. That's not our purpose at all here. Just the tragedy is that most of us are more familiar with that than what we should be familiar with. But if you read there, you'll see that the ultimate experience is one of blending in with the cosmic structure. That means an out concept of davening is not that. That might be relaxing. Might be relaxing. Might be a relaxation. But meditation is very hard work. When you snap into that level, that's a connection. Then what you have to do is draw the energy of the physical up into the spiritual, and the energy of the spiritual down into the physical, and the physical has to change. That's what has to happen. Now, that's what we mean by tefillah being a miracle. If you want to put it in more mundane terms, right, the Bala Musa expresses something like this. If you're not given too much to the mystical side, then look at it more carefully this way. When you're davened, you're asking that something should happen, okay, which wouldn't have happened otherwise. Which means when it happens, that's nothing short of a miracle. That means Hashem wasn't going to do this thing. Some of these elements we've discussed before, let's try and understand them at this level. What are you doing when you stand in front of Hashem and you're davening? I'm not talking about the meditational level, that's just a vehicle. You have to get up to that point of clarity in the mind, in the intellect, and you have to get up to that point of clarity where the ego completely stilled. That's the prerequisite, but that's when you begin. You've got to do that before you start davening. Once you've perfected that, once you can meditate perfectly, and you can get up to a level where the ego is completely still, you've got no desires of your own at all, you've got total and absolute clarity.